For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. 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 For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Right.
Welcome back to the Clink Moments of Redemption. Homicide Detective Gary Jubelin spent 34 years with the New South Wales Police Force. In this moment of redemption, Gary shares his experience with corruption and interrogating some of the worst criminals in Australia. This is the episode where the crim meets the copper.
I knew, and this probably says a little bit about my life, but I knew one of the girls that worked in the brothel, and I'd known her all my life, grown up with her. And she spoke to me and said, "Yeah, you guys are on the take." And I laughed, and I think it gives you an indication. I thought I knew the world, but I was that naive, I just didn't see it. And she said, "No, they're on the take," and I laughed about it. Then, you know, down the track, I find out she was 100% right. Small pockets, Brent. I think that's the way I look at it with the corruption in the police. Now, maybe I'm naive, but I don't go looking for it. Like, I just want to get on and do my work. Back then, I think it was small pockets. Some of the people, you know, they were very charismatic. If you talk corruption in New South Wales in the police, you talk Roger Rogerson.
Yeah.
From all reports, and I didn't work with him, but from all reports, he was very charismatic. He was good at his job, and he could, you know, people would follow him. He was a natural leader. But as a young cop in the stick-ups, I used to be in the witness box, and the cross-examination would start, say you're in the stick-ups, you bash them, you load them, don't you? That's your go. Roger Rogerson's your hero. That's the type of cross-examination I'd be getting in the witness box. And
you're referring to the old phone book era?
Yeah, phone book era, loading people up, all that. Yeah,
which basically comes into that whole perspective of corruption. You know, we talk of an era, once again, that was just rife with corruption. And, you know, crime was high, but so was crime within the authority side of it as well.
And that's the point. Like, police have cleaned up their act, but so is society. Like, I remember, growing up as a kid, all the fathers would go to the pub and they would joke how drunk they were when they drove home because the car would be parked halfway off the driveway or, you know, in the wrong driveway or whatever. But that was, you know, acceptable. Now we'd look at that and it'd just be frowned upon, quite rightly so. So there were things that occurred. Yeah, we talk, and I think this is the analogy of you need a good old cop to give the kid a kick up the arse and that sends him on the straight and narrow. It was condoned. Imagine if it was now, a cop kicking someone up the arse, captured on phones and posted on video. He'd be crucified. So the world has changed, and the police, I'm glad to say the police have changed. My only concern with, we tidied it up, from my point of view, and this is my personal side of it, as a detective, we were shamed. And senior police were coming out saying, after the Royal Commission, detectives are a disgrace, say I should go back to uniform. I pushed back on that big time. I thought, well, stuff you. I know what I've done. I've got nothing to be ashamed of. And I really pushed the line that we've got nothing to be ashamed of. And there's a fine line between going hard, because I was always thought of a detective that goes hard when I'm chasing the bad guys. I got no problem with that. I did. But I worked within the parameters. I'd stretch the parameters as far as I could, but I'd work within the parameters. And, you know, that's just the way I operated. So I think some people, once they've cleaned up the corruption, we still need an effective police force. We still need people that, you know, sometimes you've got to roll the dice and take a risk in policing. And I think we lost that a little bit. Having said that, what we've got now with the police, my observation of it, you've got some very smart people, which is good. You need the smart people. But the best cops I've worked with, and whether they're the hardcore homicide detectives, stick-ups, or the local uniform sergeant, are the ones that have got genuine empathy. And that's funny when I'm sitting here talking to you and you're probably going, what the hell? You're saying a cop with empathy.
Well, but, no. Let's just bring that in a little because I don't often speak of it, but he was my grandfather, God bless his soul. And my grandfather was a 36-year serving Crown Sergeant that
how does your family live with the shame?
Fuck, I don't know. But, you know, like he never once judged me, even when I was a juvenile going through what I went through. He was always that one there to pick me up, put me back on my feet, the only man in my life at that period that I could ever say that I loved and related to. So my point being, I remember conversations as I was growing up. I mean, he's passed on now some 20-odd years, but there was talk of what they were doing, bringing a lot of the straighter country coppers, the senior country coppers, into the city, Surry Hills, and all these places to clean up the acts of the corruption. He retired around that time purely for the fact that as a country copper, that's not what he joined the force for, was to go through all that bullshit and be dragged through, you know, all this hub of corruption and what was going on. I don't think he was the only one. Quote me if I'm wrong. But I believe that that was an era where that's what they were trying to do. And I remember him vaguely speaking about that period in his life.
Yeah, there was talk of the White Knights and the Dark Knights and all that, the division within the police and, yeah, the corrupt cops and then the ones that were, yeah, not on the take. And what I had I think because of my upbringing, and I was working in an area, I was working on garbage trucks when I was a kid and around the Redfern area and different things. So I'm exposed to all sorts of characters as a 12, 13 year old and got an eye open to life. But also got a sense of, okay, stay away from this person. That person's a problem. And I had a radar that I could step away. So I went through my career basically. Okay, I like the way that person operates. I'm going to learn from that and try and gravitate towards there. But if push comes to shove, and I'd see it, and we talked addiction and all that. The drinking culture was something that I saw bring some good people unstuck. And you start off thinking, oh, well, there's nothing wrong with just having a beer after work. And then it's, oh, well, let's have a beer at lunchtime. And it sort of creeps in. And then by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you could see them looking around and wanting to have a beer. There was a drinking culture in the cops. So there was some negative things, but I think the point I was making, whether it's stupid or just in my nature, I would stand up to people. Like if someone, it's intimidating, that detective sergeant. Yeah, you might see it from the other side. I'm saying even within the police environment. You walk into the detective's office and they're playing cards at lunchtime, smoking their cigarettes and that. It's intimidating.
So there was the sort of, you know, the inner circle within.
Yeah,
the clique,
yeah.
So to speak.
Most definitely.
And was it more, a little bit more of that sort of, the word we use today, I guess, is bullying, workplace bullying, intimidation, you know, sort of.
Yeah, well, I and look, we again, that's another thing that we needed to change. But I laugh when people talk about being bullied at work. Not that I'm laughing at people being bullied at work, but if they had any idea what it was like to be in the cops in my day, like, yeah, the person I was talking about that did get caught for corruption, he put me on basically a year of afternoon shift because he liked working on the afternoon shift and going to the local club or pub or whatever. And sometimes I'd get a phone call as a young detective saying, is anything happening? And I'd go, yeah, actually, I've got a couple of people handcuffed to the desk over there. I'm getting statements from victims here. It's pretty busy. And they'll say, and he'd say, well, give me a call if it gets busy and I'll come back and help you. Yeah. So, that was the environment. I laugh at it because there were some characters in there and there's some funny sides in there. But, yeah, the world has changed and we definitely, it definitely wouldn't work with today's standards.
No, not at all, and not from either side of the fence. Gary, there's, and we'll talk obviously a little bit more about these, there's some very high-profile cases that you have definitely had a massive hand in, and two in particular for me that I've, taken an interest was the Barrowville and obviously the William Tyrrell. Let's talk about something that wasn't obviously maybe as high-profile that you were a part of during that period.
Yep. There's other cases that I recognise for the difficult or the high profile cases for whatever reason. But there was some one of my first murders that I was involved in from sort of start to finish. murder of an elderly lady. I won't mention the name out of respect for the family, but she was in her 80s, and her house was broken into. She was sexually assaulted, tied up, and sexually assaulted and murdered. And I remember working on that case, and I was just shocked by it. Yeah, that this could happen. This is a real predator. This was someone evil. We ended up catching him probably 3 or 4 months on the investigation. I learned a little bit as a detective in that, I'm all for tunnel vision, but tunnel vision takes you in a direction to prove or disprove. But we had someone very much in the sights for that case, and he had an association with the church that the lady went to. He was also seen near the vicinity, running away from the vicinity. He gave a detailed statement of seeing someone else at the vicinity that just wasn't there. And what else was his? Oh, he was also door knocking on elderly ladies' places round there, asking for glasses of water, because we couldn't work out how someone broke into a house because it hadn't been broken into.
This wasn't that North Shore one.
No, this wasn't the granny killer. This is another one. And this bloke, for all intents and purposes, he was our man. And we went after him. We had surveillance on him, got DNA. And then this was one of the first DNA cases that came to the fore. And it wasn't him. And I remember myself and my partner going, what the hell? What would these scientists know? You know, they've got this little chart saying DNA. No, the semen found at the scene is not his. Then we found the right person, and when we arrested him, it was quite chilling when we were interviewing him, because he was describing the crime, and he was getting himself excited describing the crime, and he was also looking to target other people at the time. And I remember when I came out of that interview room with my partner Jim, like, people think we come out of an interview room and it's high five, we've got him because he confessed, and but just felt really drained, like you felt dirty because we're sitting.
Just on that for a second, and I think it's really important to talk about this, is the mindset of someone like yourself, your partner, and I will use this term, that this twisted sicko would commit such a crime, because it'll never be accepted in any walk of life, whichever side of the fence you're from.
Yeah.
How does someone humanely walk out of there not wanting to rip his eyeballs out of his head and jump all over him, knowing that he just did this to this poor elderly woman and was excited? I mean, that to me just... Yeah. How do you see it, and do you then move forward and come back into that room and I guess maintain integrity and you know, not lose that sort of humane, I guess, reaction to want to just throttle him?
I understand what you're saying, and we've all got those human emotions, and you know, it would sit very well just throttling him on the spot. Mm. But when I say I play hardball, how I play hardball is I make sure I don't do that. I just make sure I'm professional the whole way down, so he has got no way whatsoever of beating this charge. Yeah. And when I'm sitting there opposite someone like that, once he started telling me how he was doing this and doing that, if I sat back in just... disgust, or just said, oh, you piece of shit, which I felt like saying, what I was thinking, he might not talk. So I just have to sit there.
Do you think he might have got off on knowing that he was making you react like that too, if that had happened?
Well, I can't say with him. I think he was just caught up in his own little world. But there was another one, one that I'm very familiar with, that I did, where he had abducted a young girl and murdered the father or the stepfather in her presence. And I got him and interviewed him. He was a pedophile. And no ifs or buts, he was getting off on telling me what he did and the details, how he sexually assaulted the young girl and that.
Check out more of Brent and Gary Jubelin on season 6 of The Clink.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. 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 For the record.